Do we have the number of children? We have the dollars.
We usually divide the dollars into the two and get an estimated number.
So maybe Eileen can do that, and we'll move to the next question.
Because I'm just curious, because the purpose of them is for the lower income,
right.
And I'm also how many total children are in preschool. I have to tell you, even though I'm education-based, I supported the mayor's plan that it's not a core service, mm-hmm. and it was not serving the lower incomes as needed. And in East Portland, we've already, in our districts, put in three programs in schools, elementary schools already, so I don't think our lowest income are being served by parts. But I do support the scholarship. In regard to Selwood, I have to, with Commissioner Saltzman, it's kind of, I'm reading this, and one of your, one of the CBO's items is that what other community centers are close to Selwood, but the two they mention are also two you're talking about closing, which seems kind of odd.
The closest one actually is probably a full service is Mount Scott Community Center.
Yeah, for full service, but I'm just talking about what they recommended, and
I just want to know, we're not recommending closing Selwood for some of those exact reasons
but
you're
I'm
pointing
just saying
out.
It's kind of ironic it was put on, those were put on together when they, they really, that they're, you should
there's
have
an,
one
there's
there.
An interaction potentially, that's right.
And,
Sixty scholarships out of 600
students.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's a pretty small amount.
10%. Yeah.
Yeah. That's for considering the focus of the program was to help lower income families and stuff. In regard to Fulton Park, it seems like if it hasn't been open and it's been used by someone else, it seems like an illogical cut. So I'm supporting the CBO's office recommendation on that. There's one item, eliminate service to non-core properties. And is that mowing? I was trying to get a sense of when you talk.
Those are undeveloped properties primarily, so they're properties that likely have growth. I don't know whether there's mowing
parks?
On the properties or
they're
if it's just general
properties.
Maintenance.
Uh-huh. They're parks properties, but they're not developed in any way. So
okay, well, I'm going to give an example because there's one in East Portland, Gates Park, which isn't developed, doesn't have a master plan, but it's a very big area. Are you considering not mowing?
No. And it's not all of them. It's a select few group. So this is James Allison, our land stewardship manager.
Thank you for the question. To clarify, these are parcels that have been acquired over time. There is no, not like Gates Park, there are no plans for these parks. There are no plans for these properties. There are no plans for planning these properties. They've been acquired, sometimes donated, sometimes tax foreclosures. Most of them are in a state where there is not turf grass that needs to be mown. There might be one or two exceptions. Gates property, known as Gates Park, is not on the list.
Okay.
And then we'll be looking at, can we sell them?
Yeah, that's what would be my next thought on that. I know I had another question in here. In regard to the trail cleanup, that was one of the reduction you suggested. It seems like that would have given the problems we've had out on the Springwater Trail, that would have a big impact if that cleanup or whatever you want to call it is reduced.
Just for a quick context, as was presented in Mike's presentation, we have about 147 developed parks, about 73 natural areas. Our daily work is taking care of things on two fronts. One is what I would call living assets, trees, grass, ornamental plants, the reason people come to parks for that green, that beauty. The second is what I would call clean and safe activities where a restroom needs to be opened, trash cans need to be emptied, playground equipment needs to be inspected. We have a limited number of people to do that every day across the system. as part of these drastic budget cuts, we needed to look where we could reduce service but not eliminate it in the way that was least impactful to park users. Regional trails provide, unlike a neighborhood park, regional trails provide recreational and transportational opportunities. We felt that we, if we had to in a budget cut, we could reduce our inspection of those trails from some trails get twice, some trails get weekly and some get twice a month. We were, as part of this budget package, cutting that service in half, so we will still be out there. We could still be demand-driven, but we can't maintain that level of service and still get to opening restrooms every day, inspecting playgrounds, cleaning garbage cans. So it's to provide a budget cut, we need to provide this reduction in service at these sites. But to answer your question, it will have an impact.
Yeah, there is a concern out there. I'm going to bring up a concern because of David Douglas. You have a Floyd Light Park. It's hidden. It's up in the trees. There's a real problem with homelessness there. The district's been dealing with the problem for several years. And, in fact, one of the principal and custodian's job first thing is the morning to go onto our property, which we've totally cleared to keep them from camping on our property, and pick up needles. And it appears, based on what the neighbors are saying, there's not much done by parks on that park. So how do you pick and choose? Because we have a big problem. Which parks to do that?
Yeah, very, very familiar with that site next to East Portland Community Center. Okay. There's a little bit of a discrepancy over whose property is whose. We do inspect that site weekly, the small fir forest between the community center turf and the track. Uh-huh. But we are there regularly, and Scott Dominey, our park maintenance supervisor, is in regular touch with the Portland or the school district folks.
Okay, I just get... Yeah. Unfortunately, they don't come here in Yale. They come to our school district in Yale because they think it's our property.
But oh, no. Frida, they come here too. We get it.
Okay, we're both getting hammered about this one little park. No. So, anyway, well, thank you.
Mike, can I just, and I have to leave in 1 second for a RAC interview, but I think it's worth noting, I hope we do at the beginning of each of these sessions, that the mayor in his... budget guidance asks people to identify a 5% cut. And I think that's called modified zero-based budgeting. And I've been on this council long enough, so I can say that when it actually is done right, what it does is it helps decision-makers like us understand what your stakeholders believe is core and what is less core. And that, you know, I have two children. Don't ask me which one I love more. I get that. We love all our children. We love all of our programs. And I'm going to make, you know, a modest little declaration here that that it is highly unlikely Parks is going to be asked to take many of these cuts when we get our revised end of April forecast. I think we're going to have different numbers. But I will say that it is a very useful exercise for us to hear, you know, every year, what's fundamental to what you do, and if you had to go without, you know, what would you go without and why? And unfortunately, we are starting to get all these emails saying, save this, save this. And I think it's just worth reminding people that this is a budget exercise. This is a chance for us to have information we need, because if it's not this year, it could be next year that we have to make some tougher choices, or the year after. But I was listening to your conversation with Frida. Do you have a current list of properties that are likely in the next 5 to 10 years to be surplus?
Yes, we do, Commissioner.
So yep. Could I see that list?
Sure.
I think that information will be enormously helpful in this parallel effort we're going through about looking at affordable art spaces and thinking about properties that the city owns that may... in the right circumstances, be available to groups that are now feeling priced out in terms of the arts. So if I could, at your leisure, see that list.
Yep. And most of them don't have buildings on them, but a few do. So we'll share the whole list.
Thank you. Then I'm going to ask that we wrap it up.
I think you also have a list of the facilities and properties that are most used by people of color. And if we could see that, that would be great, too. because it's one of the priorities of equity and inclusion is one of the priorities of the city.
I would just say that what we can provide and we have data for is at our community centers.
That's right.
With voluntary information that people have given us. We really don't for parks because we don't have a way of mm-hmm. counting or interviewing. But we'll get you, it's called our PREP data, Parks, Race, and Ethnicity Project. So we'll get you that data.
Although I will say that with the change in the federal administration, we have backed off on that because people are really concerned about being identified going into spaces, public spaces. So we were having a more robust trying to gather that information and just not knowing who might get it. We are not quite so diligent on that at this point.
Very good. We are, Frida, you had something quickly.
Just one comment on the excess property. I believe the city opened it up so that the Housing Bureau would have first crack at that for affordable housing. I'd also recommend for the larger pieces to contact your school district. I know David Douglas is very short on land out in our area, but we still have overcapacity issues. So if you could
okay.
make sure people know.
Good. All right. It's 11:42. We'll reconvene at 11:50.
Doing the crowd. just as long as they get to the buffer.
Thank you.
We want to see more affordable housing and less luxury housing. Can you make that happen? Yeah. So there's other convincing that needs to happen here? Is that what you're saying? Because when we look at these numbers, the crisis is just going to get worse. Everyone can see the writing on the wall. But it's like the deferred maintenance. Millions of dollars to try and manage a crisis that we have no reason to believe is not going to be a crisis in 5 years, 10 years. I mean, that's crazy.
How? We're making the right decision.
No.
All right, we are back in session, everybody. Thank you. Up next is the Bureau of Emergency Communications. Good afternoon, Director.
Good afternoon.
Interim.
Go ahead and start?
Yes, please.
Before I get started, I do want to introduce our incoming director who's been appointed by the mayor, Bob Causey, who's here to watch today.
We don't want to put him on the hot seat.
We're not going to put him on the hot seat. I considered it.
Next time, Bob.
Definitely next time, Bob. So good morning, Mayor Wheeler and council members. Pleased to be here today and talk to you a little bit about BOIC and about what we've accomplished in this past year and specifically how those accomplishments have contributed to the mayor's priority areas, specifically relating to increasing public safety.
Could you put your name into the record, please?
I apologize. Thank you. My name is Lisa St. Helen. I'm the interim director for BOIC. So the contributions that we've made specifically relating to increasing public safety and in pursuing innovation. Also would like to talk briefly about what we're hoping to accomplish and what our budget requests are this year and how we anticipate utilizing those to do the same. So just quickly to run through some of our accomplishments, I think it should be noted that we worked for quite a while with the CBO's office to reestablish some of our performance standards. Those performance standards that dealt with call taking or call performance were brought into alignment with national standards, and that is what we work towards today. Other performance standards that had to do more with citywide delivery of services. I've worked with the city, with the CBO's office to look at redefining those and making those more citywide performance standards as opposed to performance standards held strictly for BOIC. So we've gotten that work done, and everything that we are doing now, everything that we'll talk about today, leads us back to those goals of meeting those performance standards. The one thing I'd like to talk about also is our really strong efforts this year at pursuing innovation. We took to heart the mayor's recommendation to pursue innovation, and we have done so with, I think, great success and without asking for additional staffing or for additional monies. Two things have come out of that effort. The first was a new scheduling forecasting system. The reason I think this is important to you, Mayor, and to the council members and to the city is that historically we have looked at our call loads and we have taken educated guesses, definitely educated, but they are guesses nonetheless, about how we're going to staff our bureau. We have high call loads at 5 in the afternoon. We have lower call loads at 5 in the morning, and we staff kind of guessing we're going to put 10 folks here and 3 folks here. This scheduling forecasting system allows us to put into it information such as what my desired outcome is. In other words, I want to meet our national standard of answering 95% of our calls within 20 seconds. That's my desired outcome. I can then tell it the information that's already in the system is data pertaining to our actual call loads for every hour of every day. And then I can put in what my staffing numbers are, and it will tell me, based on those staffing numbers, based on what my desired outcome is, what percentage of time I'm going to meet those performance goals. The important part to that is that not only does it help me staff the Bureau more effectively. In other words, I know where I need more people. I can justify where I need more people and where I need less people. But it also will show you, it will show anybody looking at it, what the impacts of staff increases will be and what the impacts of staff decreases will be. We can show you comparing what our performance performance goals are, what the impact would be if we took away people or if we added folks, and how that changes those performance goals or the amount of time that we're able to reach them. The other thing that we have done related to that position is we have taken control of our statistics. Historically, all of our statistics have come to us through BTS, and there has not been a filter. There's not been a bureau filter. We just take that information from them. We all know that we have had a history that reported inaccurate statistics. This is our answer to that, and now what we have is a system in place where we work collaboratively with BTS. We have a person that has operational knowledge, but very strong analytical knowledge, and we are now able to take that information and provide statistics regarding all aspects of our bureau that we know analytically are correct, but are also operationally correct. And what that means is I can look at those numbers that are given to me, and I can say, based on what my knowledge is of what's happening on our operations floor, those numbers make sense. Those I know are accurate, and that's how we know that we can now present a dashboard that has accurate information in it. Additionally, we've implemented an entirely new phone system that was put into place in November of 7th that is providing for far better statistics and analytical capabilities. We have made changes to our training program in an attempt to shorten the time that it takes to certify a senior dispatcher, which now sits on average about 14 to 16 months. And we've taken many efforts to address issues related to attrition, non-expected attrition, so things outside of retirement. So we're working on things like changing the culture and providing better support, both mentally and physically, for employees that are doing work of 911, which obviously is a very tough and stressful job. So all of these efforts have helped us to increase our staffing. Over this past year, we're currently allocated at 118 FTE. As of yesterday. We're sitting at about 108 employees. 95 of those are contributing to the call load, so they're certified in call taking or above. Beyond that, we have 13 that are in training that are working their way towards call taking certification. Beyond that, we have another academy starting in April, and we have an recruitment open right now for the academy that will start in September. So I anticipate that our staffing levels will reach that 118 FTE, not fully certified, but in the pipeline by the end of calendar year 2018 or early 2019. So that leads me to the next topic, which is we were asked to address what the largest threat is to our bureau in regards to meeting our service level targets. For BOIC, that's a pretty easy question, because the biggest threat to us would be any decision that would be made that would prevent us from continuing to run our three academies per year. What we have learned and what we know is that our success is our trainees. Our success are having trainees in the pipeline at every phase. So we need to have early phase trainees, mid phase trainees, and late phase trainees to replace folks who leave. In a typical office environment, folks put in their notice and they are gone in 2 weeks or in 4 weeks. For BOIC to replace an employee who leaves us, there is a 6-month hiring process. There's a 14 to 16 month training process before that employee is fully replaced. So it is imperative that we have folks in that training pipeline to replace those people when they go. The most recent example is we did have a CAD replacement here back in 2010, 2011, and the decision was made at the time to cease all hiring. When you look at our staffing since that point, it has steadily declined because we didn't have folks in the pipeline. Basically, once you start losing people and when you don't have folks there, to replace them, you're already 2 years behind the gun. So the answer to that is that we would like very much to keep our trainees, our academies going, so we have folks there. Quickly, just to address the ad packages that we did put into our budget this year, one was for a logging system. That is for those who don't know, that's a recording system. We are required to record everything that happens on our operations floor when it comes to calls and dispatch. Right now, the system that we have is outdated. It is non-industry specific. And what that means is that it doesn't function to serve our needs when it comes to issues like quality assurance and such. Our current system has had multiple system failures in the last year, which means when public records requests come in that we are required to respond to, we are not able to do so because the recordings don't exist. And that obviously is a very big problem that puts us out of compliance with OAR, and we definitely want to rectify that by getting a new system. The new system that we would be looking at, there are a few on the market. We have identified those. Those are industry-specific. Those will lend themselves to a stronger QA system that we are currently in the process of implementing at BOIC by making calls far easier to pull for review. Historically, I have watched BOIC try to implement more times than I can count different types of quality assurance programs, which are vital to a 911 center. All of them have failed. They are not sustainable because of the time intensiveness of pulling the calls and reviewing them. This would help to support that. The second request package that we have in our budget, integrated priority dispatch. This is a cost of $950,000. We are looking at requesting to move $200,000 from our contingency to that effort. There is $400,000 in the public safety technical fund that could assist in paying for that. So we are asking for a $350,000 one-time general fund resource to help in that purchase. I did bring along a person far more knowledgeable than myself in integrated priority dispatch, so if there's further questions as we move forward, I'll bring Ryan up. But just to address quick points on that, It does increase, having this process, it does increase responsiveness for emergencies. It does allow for more precise triaging. It can decrease time at call implementation at the start, but will ultimately end up speeding up the training time it takes to get folks certified. With accreditation comes the ability to implement other types of methods in which we can handle calls, including nurse lines, nurse hotlines, and other resources that we can send folks to so that emergency responders are not sent to calls when they are not statistically warranted. It should be noted up front that there are ongoing costs to having integrated priority dispatch. So there is the initial initial cost of getting it implemented. In order to be accredited, there are additional yearly costs as well. And those are listed in here also. And our last request package was for a timekeeping and administrative support position. Our Bureau operates with no administrative support at all, and we have had little overlap in duties. So we have a lot of folks that are having to do things that are spending a lot of time taking meeting minutes or scheduling meeting rooms or backing up other positions in timekeeping and such. And so we were looking for that position to try and be a coverall for that.
Good. I have a couple of questions related to the budget, both on the next generation recording system and the IPDS. It's my understanding that we could ask our partners to help subsidize the cost of those systems. And I'm wondering, A, have we asked them, and B, given that the IGA allows us to do that, shouldn't that be part of the equation?
Yeah, I can give you a little bit of history. I will also defer to Gary because he has a lot more historical knowledge than I do. But I can tell you that in the past, this has been brought up before. It has always been the city's stance that capital purchases, capital investments should belong to the city. And it has been decided that partner agencies do not contribute to that effort. We are not opposed to putting that out to our partner agencies. I will say our biggest issue would be for this current fiscal year, asking them to do so now would be past the point in which they've already submitted their budgets.
So how about on an ongoing basis then, particularly with IPDS? I mean, the IGA allows it. Why wouldn't we do it?
Hello.
Hi. Name for the record, please, sir.
As Lisa said, this has come up. My name's Gary Bevins. I'm the financial analyst at BOIC. This has come up over the years, over the last 5 and 10 years, and when it's come up, the question has been, what do we do? What position does this put the city if, say, Gresham should decide to separate and start up their own 911 center? Do we then have to repay them for their percentage ownership of capital assets? There have been some discussion from the financial people downtown. They said, how do you ensure or manage a partially owned asset? So that's been the question. It hasn't been a question of whether or not it's legal, whether or not they would do it. It's what do we do if we have a partially owned asset? The position the city's taken has been that we want to own them 100%, and so it hasn't been pursued.
So I'll be very clear. I don't take that position at all. If there is an opportunity for economies of scale, and there's an opportunity for us to work collectively with our partners, and the IGA, the Intergovernmental Agreement, allows for us to be able to accept their contributions into the system, that lowers everybody's ongoing operating costs. Why wouldn't we do that?
Well, you're the commissioner in charge. You get to have that discussion.
That is correct. I do. And so I'm just trying to figure out why that, in the context of this budget, why that has not been offered.
I believe the reason it was not offered in this budget and in our budget submission was because historically when that has been brought up, it has always been the decision from the city that they would be owned by the city. So okay.
The city, are you referring to legal counsel or are you referring to
the
city council? Okay, well, anyway, we'll put that in the parking lot for a future discussion.
As far as moving forward, from a Bureau's perspective, at least from my perspective, I don't see any reason why we cannot move that forward onto our partner agencies and ask for contributions in that regard. The only thing I would say is that for this fiscal year, we have bypassed the point in which they've submitted their budgets. They might not be in a position to do so.
Okay, and that's fair. Frida, I think, and then Rob.
Oh, because you mentioned that, and I understand about splitting ownership and all that, but is there a possibility that you charge them a rental fee? You see what I'm saying? Instead of that, you have your operating costs that exclude that, I'm assuming, that they're getting the use of this equipment, maybe looking at it a little differently than just being part of the purchase, but maybe a rental fee.
And the argument around the capital purchase, that's a reasonably compelling argument to me, but it is not compelling to me that we should not pursue ongoing operating recovery. I mean, it is a legitimate service needed by our jurisdictional partners, and given that we do have finite resources, why not? So I think we're in agreement, Frida.
Yeah.
Rob.
And there are certainly areas where that occurs. There's a rent that we pay to facilities that includes a major maintenance component that is a cost share to all of our partners, so that when the building repairs needed, they are co-funding that. We pay about $600,000 to our CAD vendor for ongoing support of that system, and that's considered an operating cost, and they share in that expense as well.
Very good.
So there are areas where that occurs.
We covered it. I had.
I was just going to agree with you. So.
Oh, well, please do so. The microphone is yours, sir. One other question that came from my staff, and I'm going to try and get this right. With regard to the timekeeping administrative support position, CBO had actually recommended that rather than doing that, you instead rely on resources from the Department of Human Resources as a way to assist the staff transitions. And they also suggested that you realign existing resources to procure an ESS software capable of handling the diverse types of pay that the EC ops use, and that the installation of that with the next generation recording system would in fact free up or at least decrease the demand on two FTE that then could be used for other administrative work. And I know that you've had this conversation, but I'm wondering if you could just daylight your thinking on that.
Yeah, we've had pieces of that conversation. I think the first thing, the clarification I want to make there is that the developing or finding an ESS system to get our folks onto a standard timekeeping system that's more efficient is absolutely a priority that we should be looking at, and we have most recently looked at that this past month. It is not a possibility with the current system that the City of Portland utilizes. Having said that, there are other bureaus in this city that have gone out and found tailor-made, if you will, custom-made timekeeping capture systems. So that is something that we definitely want to look at in the future. We just have not gotten there yet.
But it requires next gen to be in place. Is that what I'm hearing?
I don't know that that's actually accurate. I don't think that that's accurate. It does not have anything at all to do, and that was the other clarification I want to make. That system itself does not play into the logging system. Those are two separate things.
Does the ECC software, does that play into it?
The ECC software.
The ESS software does not play into the logging system at all.
It's an entirely separate. One is basically a recorder of audio and of CAD of computer dispatch work, and one is a timekeeping system. They're two entirely separate.
So maybe what I could do is when I have my separate meeting with you, could we have a prep conversation around
absolutely.
That? Good. I'd like to hear your thinking on
that.
Good. Rob, did you have a? Another question. Show, good afternoon, show. It's good to see you. Great. I love the way this is going. It's fairly rare in this room that happens. Any further questions?
I just have a comment. Director St. Helens, thank you for your work on the Bureau. It's really impressive how much you've been able to move the dial on the performance measures in the time that you've been interim director, and I very much appreciate it. The other thought I have, Mayor, is that perhaps we should have a city policy like the financial sustainability policy that we have in BDS, that when certain indicators start happening, then certain layoffs or whatever start happening. We learned both in the police and in Bureau of Emergency Communications during the recession that although the short term we can't keep hiring people seemed like the right decision at the time, over the long run, it has not been the right decision and got us into trouble, you know, 3 or 4 years later. So I'm wondering if we should have some kind of a policy along those lines about specifically hiring new people to keep the pipeline going, both in police and BOIC.
I thank you for that comment. I appreciate that. I would make one comment regarding that, is that it does seem to be something that we have to continually relearn over the years, and I don't know why that is. I have seen decisions made in the past that, okay, we're just going to stop hiring. We don't have the money to hire. We're not going to hire. We know what that outcome is going to be. We know what that's going to look like in 4 years, and we know what that's going to look like in 5 and 6 years, and we know in about 6 or 7 years we might recover if we're able to get those academies going again. There's no question. We know what the outcome is going to be, so it would be nice to get something documented to where we're not having to retrain new folks in whatever capacity we're holding within the city 5 years down the road, 10 years down the road, 15 years down the road.
So one other question. You've spent a considerable amount of time working on the issue of staffing and getting to full staffing and looking at the scheduling question, and I share Commissioner Fritz's thanks for the hard work that you and your team have done there. It's been, in my opinion, fantastic work. What do you see as the challenges in this specific budget with regard to, well, first of all, do you see yourself meeting your full staffing goals? When do you see yourself meeting full staffing goals? And what challenges does this budget provide in terms of getting there?
I think the largest challenge is kind of what I mentioned before, is I think the only challenge that we truly cannot overcome is any decision that would prohibit us from hiring those academies. And specifically, I'm referring to that 5% budget reduction would eliminate 11 positions, which would be an entire a full academy. That would be a problem. As far as when I think that we're going to reach staffing, I think that we will be at our FTE probably at the end of this year, beginning of next calendar year. As far as when we could possibly reach full certified staffing, I think we're probably looking at 18 to 24 months after that. And I would also mention that based on the scheduling forecaster that I'm utilizing now, which is relatively new and we're still learning from it, I think that it is likely that we will come back at a certain point and state that if the city expectation, and it should be, is that we meet that 95% of the calls are answered within 20 seconds, it might be more than 118 people that we need, depending on what our call load is. The good news is with the scheduling system that we have in place now, we can show you. We can show you statistically what that looks like. So.
Great. Thank you. I appreciate that. Further questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor. Thank you.
Appreciate it very much. Thank you. Last but not least, the Bureau of Emergency Management. And then, colleagues, depending upon the time, Andrew had indicated he'd like to do some of the mapping as well at the end of the presentation if we have time. Good afternoon and welcome.
Good afternoon, Mayor, Commissioner. My name is Corey Patterson. I'm the Bureau Director.
I don't know. Doesn't there you go.
Right. Good afternoon, Mayor, Commissioners. My name is Courtney Patterson. I'm the Interim Director for the Portland Bureau of Emergency Management.
Great. And Courtney, these are very sensitive, so just like 6 inches have found is just about ideal.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Okay. I'm very pleased and honored to be here today to present PBEM's budget. I want to stress that we are a very small portion of the city's budget. We are a little less than $3.5 million, and I believe that the city gets a huge value for their investment in emergency management. I wanted to highlight a couple significant issues, mainly the increased emergency management incidents that we've been having. Our days at enhanced monitoring have been going up and up. So we started at 5 in 2015, we went to 12 in 2016, and last year we had 29. Thus far already, 2.5 months into 2018, we've had 7. at Enhanced Monitoring, our duty officers put away their normal work and monitor a public safety incident within the city. That's also when the bureau directors and electeds at the table will receive a situation status report from us. If this trend continues in 2018, we'd expect to have another 28 days. Partial ECC activations have also continued to rise. Last year we had 6. Thus far, we've already had 2 days. I think most of you know on Monday and Tuesday we had an evacuation in Northeast Portland. When we talk about 1 day of a partial ECC activation, it actually is 3 work days for our staff since we go into 24-hour operations. To give you an idea, we worked 32 hours straight on Monday and Tuesday. Most of my staff worked for about 24, 25 hours. I worked for 27. So it's a heavy load on our bureau. Our staff are FLSA exempt, so we basically eat that where each of us takes overtime. It delays our other projects. For example, we had a flood tabletop exercise planned for our flood plan, and we've now postponed that twice, both for actual activations. These hazmat incidents like we had yesterday are not common. The last that we had was 7 years ago, and the census tract estimates are that 3,304 people were affected. You might ask yourself, why is this happening, or how does this relate to the mayor's priorities? One of the main things is that we're addressing life safety risks that are unique to houseless individuals. So Johnson Creek is a great example of flooding that affects homeless but not others. It also happens along the Columbia River. Johnson Creek is in southeast Portland, and its flooding affects the built environment, so roads and buildings at 11 feet. It affects homeless that are camping within the banks of the river. So when we say that it's flooding and it's affecting homeless people, it actually isn't. The river is within the established banks for it, and that's at 6.5 feet. So there are no computer systems or alerts that will warn us at that low of a level, and so the PBM duty officer has to manually go in and check the website every hour or two to make sure that it's not rising to the level that would affect homeless. And make sure that outreach to those individuals is coordinated. There's also severe winter and summer weather. When it's extremely cold or extremely hot, it doesn't affect most of us, but it is truly life-endangering for homeless, especially those that have mental health diseases. We've had many incidents where there's individuals without shoes, without coats, that are out in 20-degree weather. Aging infrastructure can also cause public safety incidents. For us, we've had several power outages downtown. The downtown power structure is older, and as they upgrade the system, there have been breaks, and we've had several downtown power outages in the last several years. And then there have also been protests where we've had to activate the city ECC. I also wanted to highlight some progress we've made from last year's budget packages. Specifically, we really would like to thank Council for their support of the Neighborhood Emergency Team Program. Our current numbers are up there. So we have 1,513 volunteers and 77 net teams. The net volunteers are really there when you need them. There were 21 that reported after 10 p.m. on Monday night. They assisted with radio communications. They worked at the shelter. And they transferred residents from transportation from their homes to the shelter. I also wanted to highlight the volunteer hours that our nets contribute and the FTE equivalent for our staff. I know that we've gotten questions from this group before, and we also got them again from the CBO's office about the administrative staff that our bureau keeps. And I wanted to highlight that our volunteers fall under the city's protections for workers, so Title II, Title VI, HR 2.02 complaints, all of that has to be covered by our staff. We also do background checks and IDs for all of the volunteer staff. So although we love the program, there is an administrative burden. We have a current class of 330 students and another class scheduled on May 5th for 100 students. I've included the coverage map for net by neighborhood. That was a question that we received last year, so I included it. I also wanted to highlight our equity work. We see equity as core to our work. After a disaster, data shows that those accessing our programs will be from poor communities, homeless, people with access and functional needs, those who are over 65 after Katrina, 60% of the injuries were to those over 65, and after the Japanese earthquake and tsunami, it was 65%. We also know that because of intersectionality, that people of color will be disproportionately represented among those. So we are addressing equity in our work. We're very proud that 40.8% of our bureau are people of color. All of our staff attend Undoing Institutional Racism, which is a 2.5-day course, and we're bringing them back for a follow-up for our all-staff retreat. Decision packages, our 5% cut was not recommended by the CBO. Thank you for that. I just would like to stress that these are our core programs. Last year, Council funded us away from the EMPG grants. We did not have to rely on the EMPG grant for these core services, and you know, we're hoping not to have to rely on that again. I also wanted to talk about the continuity of operations planner position. This position is a relatively low dollar value, but we would get a lot of benefit from it as a city. This position was funded twice through one-time dollars, and we requested it from ongoing this time. The position will continue COOP work with all bureaus, serving as the subject matter expert, and it will continue the momentum from the previous 2 years. CBO strongly recommended the BTS COOP position, and we would argue that the BTS COOP planner could not do their work without the citywide continuity of operations planner. This person would also serve as a duty officer, so they would help us with the increasing incidents that I mentioned. And a portion of this work would also go towards building resilience within the city. So this is to help small businesses develop COOP plans, nonprofit organizations. And this addresses some of the recommendations from the City Club that talked about building private, public-private partnerships and allowing nonprofits to continue with their business COOP. With that, I'll open it up for any questions.
Question? Yes, sir. Commissioner Saltzman.
Thank you, Courtney. I really want to express my thanks to all of our NET volunteers who are here and maybe listening. But so I'm curious, is there an upper limit or a desirable, do we have a number? How many NET volunteers do we desire? I mean, putting aside the administrative issues, what is our theoretical maximum amount of NET volunteers we'd like to have in the city? Is there a maximum?
That's a great question. I'll bring up Jeremy Van Curen, who's our NET manager.
Right.
So this is Jeremy Van Curen, for the record, and I supervise the NET program. We haven't really placed an upper limit on the number of NETs. I mean, we could keep going with the program and we'd still not have enough. But I think one of the things that we want to do now is also place a lot of emphasis on household preparedness, which we've been deferring to the Red Cross quite a bit on in previous years. But I think we're really starting to take a closer look at that. And our NET volunteers, I believe, are going to be promoting more of that agenda in their own communities. Mm-hmm. So our NETs are, in fact, going to be spreading that message of preparedness so that for prospective volunteers who would like a lower barrier of entry than the 30 hours that it takes to become a NET volunteer, we can get them upstream, so to speak.
Are we still actively promoting people to follow becoming NET volunteers?
We are still actively promoting, but right now our focus is primarily on underserved communities in the city of Portland, and by that I mean specifically East Portland and also communities of color who are underrepresented in our program. So we're starting to focus a lot more on that.
Okay.
And certainly one goal would be an active team in each neighborhood.
I can tell you that as a NET volunteer, the active team issue is a real one. I mean, there are 1,513 active volunteers for a city of a population of 650,000-700,000 people, right? So, I mean, you're not talking about a very high proportion of the population, and we're going to hope that that number were closer to 1 to 50 or 1 to 100 when we have a Cascadia Zone event. I mean, and so in terms of neighborhoods, I mean, you can the chart that we were presented shows the density of NET volunteers, but that doesn't tell you how many of those volunteers are actively engaged in the neighborhood planning process. For example, in our Northwest district, we our that team has been somewhat quiet for the last few years, and we're just sort of trying to reconstitute ourselves again. And with turnover in the city and new volunteers and stuff, it's an ongoing challenge. Plus, the neighborhoods around us don't really have much at all. There's nothing in Goose Hollow. Pearl is great, but not too much in Hillside and the industrial district north of it. So I think this is an area that the city needs to continue to build, because we know that in contrast to places that have more frequent earthquake activity, say Japan, where there's just huge awareness everywhere and active participation by widespread, that we have a long way to go.
Okay. Thanks.
Could I ask you about the continue of operations plan? The CBO obviously did not support the position. So what do you see? Let's assume that the city council accepted that recommendation, and obviously we're not prepared to accept that recommendation today or any other recommendation, so this is hypothetical. But if you did not get that funding, how would you ensure your COOP plan across bureaus without that position?
Our bureau is not able to absorb the work from that position with our current staff. So the COOP reports would go away, and the citywide expertise of a central COOP planner would go away. We will likely have personnel.